This is Dixie Noonan with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, and I'm joined by Ron Borzakowski of the FCIC and Sarah Knaus. We are at the New York Avenue office of the Federal Reserve with Sandra Bronstein, the Director of the Division of Consumer and Community Affairs, and Dave Caperton of the Fed General Counsel's office. Ms. Bronstein, thank you so much for taking the time to meet with us today. I would like to begin just by asking you to tell us about your experience here at the Federal Reserve, how long you've been here and in what roles.
Okay. I joined the Federal Reserve in 1987, and I came in as a, I think it was titled Community Affairs Specialist, so I was a staff person in the Community Affairs Program.
That's part of the Division of Consumer and Community
Yes,
Affairs?
Okay. Yes. My entire tenure at the Fed, I've been in this division.
Okay.
So I worked in Community Affairs as a staffer for 2 years, and in 1989, I became manager of that function and expanded it considerably. I became the Community Affairs Officer and an Assistant Director of the division I think it was 98, I think. That sounds right.
How big is the division?
Well, when I joined the division, okay, do you want me to finish this?
Yeah, keep going.
Okay.
Sorry.
So, in 98, and then I became a Senior Associate Director, a few years later, and I can't remember exactly when that was. I'd have to look at the history. And then in 2004, I became division director. And in fact, today is my anniversary. It was April 1st, 2004, when I became division director.
Congratulations.
So 6 years. 6 years exactly. Not the way I would have envisioned spending my anniversary.
They brought champagne.
We'll try
Did
to
you?
Make
oh, good.
As plain as possible.
Okay, so in terms of the size of the division, that is a moving target. The division, when I joined in 1987, I think had less than 40 people in it. I want to say it was somewhere between 35 and 40 people in it. Today, our division has 120 people. So,
okay. So
it's
a lot
grown
of growth.
Exponentially. It has grown. When I took over 6 years ago as division director, there were about 80 people. We have grown it by another 50% over the last 6 years.
Huh. Great. So what we want to talk to you today about are the issues that the division works with on HOPA and on examination of non-bank subsidiaries for consumer compliance reviews. We also want to talk just a little bit about fair lending and CRA. So we're going to start with HOPA, and particularly interested, I'll just go ahead and show this. You have a few documents that we have that I think will be helpful to sort of guide this discussion a little bit, perhaps. So I'm going to give, Dave, I'll give you a copy. And this is, where is it, FCIC 114038. This is an April 8th, 1998 memo, and this is concerning a draft report to Congress on HOPA and the Truth in Lending Act. I don't know if
this was not, from what I remember, I was not involved in this preparation of this report.
Okay.
It was before I was division director. But from what I remember about this report, this was not specifically on HOPA. This was on Truth in Lending. There are some things discussed about HOPA, but it really was about Truth in Lending and RESPA.
Right. So if you turn to page 42 of this document, it talks about a draft report recommendation, the last paragraph on that page. And it says, the general conclusion from the HOPA hearings was that it is too soon to determine precisely how effective the HOPA provisions are in deterring abusive lending practices. It is clear, however, that abusive practices continue to exist. The staff believes that the Congress should consider adopting substantive protections that will target abusive lending practices without unduly restricting credit. Given the board's traditional reluctance to support substantive limitations on market behavior, the draft report discusses various options but does not advocate any particular approach to addressing these problems. So you may not know, because you said you weren't involved in working on this report, but I was sort of curious about a couple of things that this raises, and my understanding is that when HOPA was passed in 1994, that after that, throughout the years, the Fed has, from time to time, conducted public hearings.
Correct.
Across the
country.
It
was required statutorily, yes.
Right. And so the question, one of the questions I had when I read this is it talks about the board's traditional reluctance to support substantive limitations on market behavior. And I wondered if you could speak at all, maybe not necessarily to this document, since you weren't involved in drafting this document, but if that rings any bells from the way you perceived the board to look at these issues at that time.
Well, like I say, I was not involved at that time. I was working in the community affairs area. I was involved, however, we did HOPA hearings in 2000.
Okay.
Excuse me, and I was involved in those and, in fact, sat on the hearing panel for those hearings. So at that time, we wanted to look and see how the HOPA rules so far had been working. And during those hearings we held in 2000, the main issue that we heard about time and time again had to do with single premium credit life insurance. That was the major practice that people were concerned about. And we did do revisions to the HOPA rules in 2001, which effectively eliminated this product of single premium credit insurance for high-cost loans.
Did that apply only to loans that were already HOPA loans, i.e. defined?
Well, we changed the triggers on HOPA loans in those 2001 rules. We lowered the triggers so that we would include more loans in the HOPA category.
Right.
And basically, the way we set the calculation for those triggers eliminated that product. And I think everybody agreed, including the consumer groups, that we were quite successful at doing that.
Were there other substantive protections that the staff here considered?
Well, we did a few. We lowered the triggers. I think there was something, I mean, it's a long time ago, and I don't have the papers in front of me, but I think there was something at the time on flipping, preventing flipping of loans within a one-year period unless it was in the beneficial to the borrower. There were a few other substantive things that were put in place at that time.
When you say flipping, you're referring to refinancing.
Flipping homes, yes. Yes, and refinancing loans, flipping loans. That because what one of the things we heard is that people would be put into a loan and then would be flipped to a different product because you could collect the upfront fees, and that people would continually be churned into these high-cost loans. And so we did put a provision in using unfair and deceptive authority to prevent that practice from occurring unless it was in the interest of the borrower.
Well, let me ask, because I want to be clear about this. My understanding is that the HOPA statute is primarily concerned with high-cost refinancing.
Correct.
Of mortgages. There is one provision within HOPA that gives the Federal Reserve broader authority to prohibit unfair and deceptive practices with respect to all mortgages.
Correct.
Not just mortgages that would otherwise qualify as HOPA because they're high cost in refinancing.
That is correct.
So when you say that the Fed used its unfair and deceptive authority to prohibit flipping, was that under that broad provision, or was that still only with respect to...
That was with respect to the HOPA loan. So
okay.
At that time, though, you need to understand that is where we were hearing the problems were in the market.
Okay.
Was in that category of high-cost loans. The general market, we were not hearing those kinds of problems in. It was only with respect to these loans.
So let me show you this document. This is, and just take a quick look at it. Take a minute to flip through it. This is what appears to be a memo titled "The Problem of Predatory Lending," dated December 5th, 2000, FCIC 110396. Mm-hmm. Do you remember ever seeing this?
No.
We've been told that we believe the author of this.
I should say we should.
Well, wait a minute. Until
yesterday. Good.
Okay, they showed it to me yesterday, good. But that's the first time I've seen it.
Okay, good. And Dave has told us that Jim Michaels was the author of this document. Do you know Jim?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, he works for me.
Okay. Did you know him in 2000?
Yes. He worked in the division. But, again, excuse me, I was not the division director. I was in community affairs. Jim was in the regulations area, the lawyer area of regulations. We knew each other. We were in the same division. We didn't work together very much in those days.
Okay. But you did work on the HOPA hearings in 2000.
I was a member of the hearing panel, yes.
Okay. So this memo, if you turn to... Page 10. Mm-hmm. It talks about unaffordable loans.
Yes.
And this is in the context, I should say, of this appears to be proposals, recommendations for the board to consider on different rules to promulgate under its HOPA authority. So we have C, unaffordable loans, on page 10, and it says... There's this proposal that creditors may not engage in a pattern or practice of making HOPA loans mm-hmm. based on the collateral without regard to the consumer's ability to make the scheduled payments. Basically, as I read it, eliminating no documentation loans or making a loan solely based on the value of the collateral.
Requiring the ability to repay.
Right.
Yes.
Right. And there has to be some verification of the ability to repay. What's interesting, if you go to the bottom... it's at the top where it says proposed rule would expand the current HOPA rule and deem the practice of making unaffordable loans unfair for non-HOPA loans as well. And then a few bullets down, the rule would cover all mortgage, open end lines, and purchase money mortgages, except for there are a couple of exceptions.
Mm-hmm.
To your knowledge, were you aware of this rule being proposed or considered at the board?
What we ended up doing was enacting this, but for HOPA loans.
Okay.
And I knew about that. I did not know. I had not seen this, and I did not know that there was consideration of covering all mortgages.
Okay.
No,
okay.
I did not know that. I was not part of those discussions.
Okay. Do you know who might have been?
If it's Jim's document, I would think you'd ask him.
I will.
Okay.
But if you had knowledge, I wanted to ask you to.
I would assume that Dolores Smith, the previous division director, would have been involved in those discussions.
Okay.
I don't know, and other, possibly staff, besides Jim, that were here at the time.
If you turn to page 12... There's another proposal prohibiting specific acts and practices that are unfair or deceptive. The document mm-hmm. explains that the HOPA authority allows the board to prohibit practices for all mortgage loans if the board finds them to be unfair or deceptive. And then it sort of lists a number of considerations for what might be prohibited under that authority, including deceptive ads, misrepresenting loan terms, getting signatures on blank documents, etc. Affirmative misrepresentations about a borrower's qualifications for a loan, for example, orally misrepresenting that their credit score didn't make the cutoff. Were you aware of consideration of these types of
proposals? No, I was not.
Proposals? Okay.
No, I wasn't.
Is that, would it have been, if it was something that was under serious consideration, would you have known about them?
Possibly not. The conversations on what ultimately came out in the HOPA rules was held mainly with the attorneys and the governors and the board members. I was not part of those discussions at the time. Like I say, I was community affairs officer.
So you've said that you were involved in the 2000 hearings and that
yes.
the primary concern that you heard from the hearings was the SPCI.
Mm-hmm.
And flipping. Were there any other issues that were discussed here on the staff or that came up in those hearings about what the board should do? with the TOPA Authority?
I really have to say I don't remember. That was a long time ago. And the Hopi hearings that are freshest in my memory are the ones we held in 2006. So going back to 2001, I remember single premium credit insurance because that was like the biggie. I don't remember what else was discussed from those hearings, and I did not go back and look at, you know, transcripts or anything for those, but there would be transcripts of them.
Okay. Okay. Let's see. Maybe this one. That one. So now I'm giving you FCIC 114778. This is a June 30th, 2000 memo from Governor Gramlich, the chairman of the Committee on Consumer and Community Affairs, to the Board of Governors.
Okay. This was to set up the HOPA hearings?
Yes, this was to set up the HOPA hearings in 2000 and to establish what questions would be sought, what questions the board wanted to seek public comment on.
Okay.
You could turn to page 22. Number 7, misrepresentations regarding borrowers' qualifications. You could just read that paragraph.
Okay.
So is this steering? Is that basically what this is?
Yes.
So what is steering? How would you define steering?
Steering, well, it could take a number of there's a number of reasons why people are steered, but in this one, I think what they're saying is that people might qualify for prime credit, but they're steered into a subprime product, probably because the institution would make more money from them. It's higher cost.
So can I just say that this number 7 comes under a list that begins on page 19, called Restricting Certain Acts or Practices Under HOPA. The hearings will explore how the board's regulatory authority under HOPA to prohibit specific practices can be used to curb predatory lending. So that's where this list comes under.
Yes.
This is anticipating the hearings, right?
Yes.
Issues that could come up.
Right.
Okay.
And issues that I think it specifically asks, is puts forth for public comment. And then the question that this paragraph raises is what benefit to consumers might be achieved if the board issued a rule that prohibited such misrepresentations as unfair and deceptive under HOPA. So the question I have, since you were involved in the hearings, is was that a subject that came up at the hearings? And if so, what did the board...
I really don't recollect.
Okay. Do you know if the board ever considered using its HOPA authority to get at this practice?
I really don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
Okay. We've been told by some other people at the Fed that there was resistance to writing rules under HOPA against unfair or deceptive practices as they apply to all mortgages because it seems hard to write a rule that would capture practices without including things that aren't actually unfair and deceptive in a particular circumstance?
Well, it is difficult to do unfair and deceptive practices. We have done them. But it's always a case of concern about unintended consequences. And also, when you're talking about unfair and deceptive acts and practices, for many of them, they're very fact-specific to individual cases. So what is unfair to you may not be unfair to me. So one of the things you always have to weigh when you're looking at writing rules around these practices are the numbers of people that are harmed, the possible benefits of the practice to some parts of the population, and any unintended consequences in terms of restricting credit to people and other things like that. So you've got to kind of reach a balance on this stuff. It's not a slam dunk. It's never a slam dunk. It's a very difficult balance that we try to achieve and a difficult line that we walk on doing these.
Were there any things that you thought the Fed should have done after the 2000 hearings to rein in more substantive unfair practices or deceptive practices that didn't end up happening?
I really don't remember having thoughts that along those lines.
Okay, thank you. Were you involved in the rules that were adopted in July 2008?
Yes. Yeah, those I was much more involved in. I was division director at that point.
Okay,
so
okay.
I was, you know, very peripherally involved in the 2001.
Okay, correct me if I'm wrong. And Ron could definitely do this better than I could, but my understanding is that in 2008 the board did, in fact, I think for the first time, adopt rules under HOPA that applied to all mortgages, or all mortgages as defined as higher-cost mortgages. But they would
We also adopted some rules that applied to all mortgages, some unfair and deceptive practices for advertising and things like that that applied to the entire marketplace.
Right. So was there something that had changed in the way that the Federal Reserve looked at?
Well, obviously the entire context had changed. So in 2006, when we did HOPA hearings, there were a lot of issues that came out of those hearings about egregious practices that were taking place in the subprime markets, as well as practices that were happening in the prime markets where we thought it definitely warranted use of that authority. I mean, the entire time was different. The kinds of things that we saw in 2008 that we banned or restricted, in particular, there were four very egregious practices we saw in the subprime markets. One of them was the use of stated income loans, and we addressed that. The non-collection of escrows on loans because people didn't realize the true price of their loans, we addressed that. We addressed the ability to repay. That should needed to be documented, verified, that you couldn't make a loan just based on collateral, and we addressed that. And then there were prepayment penalties, which we felt unfairly trapped people into high-cost mortgages because they were like stuck in a rock in a hard place. If they wanted to get out, they had to pay a big fee, which a lot of people didn't have. And so the prepayment penalty trapped them in those. So we addressed those and pretty much eliminated them in that marketplace. Those circumstances were quite different than what you saw in the early aughts. I mean, this stuff was pretty blatant, was going on pretty widespread, and were practices that definitely needed to be addressed. And that's why we did address them.
Was there any tone change in the agency about the desire or the willingness to use sort of a broader-based authority?
Well, I think that the circumstances warranted a very aggressive approach to these practices, and that's what we did. We did what was warranted. And, you know, it's hard to make assumptions about what people wouldn't and wouldn't have done. The circumstances in 2006 and 7 and 8 were quite different than the circumstances in 2000 and 2001. So it's hard to say what those people get in the circumstances later in the aughts, so to speak, would have done under those circumstances. I mean, you can't make that assumption. But given the circumstances that we confronted, you know, it became quite obvious that we needed to act very aggressively.
Go ahead. I'm going to move on.
Yeah, before you move on, I have one more question. Going back in time, sorry to do that. After the 2001 rulemaking that took effect in 2002, there was also a Reg C change.
Yes.
It required the HOPA flag on the HMDA disclosures. When the first HMDA data came in 2005 for the 2004 year, there were surprisingly few HOPA loans flagged.
Very few.
Relative to what people had anticipated before the rulemaking. Do you remember discussions about that? Was there sort of analyses that were done?
Well, one of the reasons we put the HOPA flag on is because even back in, I do remember this, in 2000-2001, we didn't have any data, and as you know, the Federal Reserve is a very data-driven organization, which is one of its you know, positives as well as sometimes a negative. Because we tend to act when we see data to back up decisions. So we didn't have a lot of data back in 2000 on the extent of so-called high-cost loans or predatory lending, because nobody had been collecting that kind of information, and we didn't have any information about pricing of loans and things like that. So we thought that it would be helpful to put that HOPA flag on. And, yeah, I remember that people were kind of surprised by the low number of HOPA loans, but we also did make a leap at that point, or I don't know that it was a leap, an assumption that people, after we lowered the triggers, that lenders were avoiding making these loans. They didn't want to get thrown into the HOPA market because there were more things required of them. There was more liability attached. They had to do additional disclosures and things that they didn't want to do. So what we can't say, because we didn't have the data for it, is how many there were before the 2001 rules versus how many were after. We only have the after. So we don't know if the rules ended up, you know, lowering the market considerably.
And when did you find out the low number?
It was, the changes went into effect, you just said, I'm trying to remember the dates, it was like, what, 2002 or something? And then the data would have come out in like 2004
data, I think, the first time.
2004
the flag.
Data was the flag.
It was first seen in 2005.
Okay.
So when you saw the data that...
There weren't many.
In fact, there weren't actually very many loans being made that benefited from the protections of the HOPA rules.
And at that time, that's when we were considering additional HOPA rules.
Is that what prompted the hearings?
No, it didn't. The things we were hearing in the marketplace is what prompted the hearings. And it also was time. We had always planned to do another set of HOPA hearings after the rules we put into effect in 2001 had sat for a while, because we wanted to see what the effect of those were. And you can't judge that immediately. You have to give them some time to work. And so we gave them a few years, and then we had always planned to do additional HOPA hearings.
I think a question some people have is, if this data came out in 2005 and people started becoming aware of the practices in 2005 and 2006, why is it that the Federal Reserve didn't issue any regulations until July of 2008?
Okay, so the data that came out only told us how many HOPA loans there were. It didn't tell us the quality. So that data was not useful in that respect. It just told us that the loans that were covered by HOPA rules was a very small population. That's all it told us. So that didn't tell us anything about the quality of those loans. So the other thing that we need to keep in mind that is part of the context here was, at the time, in the mid-2000s, the real estate market was going very well. The property values were increasing. The loan people were increasing home ownership, which at that time was touted by everyone, including Congress and the person living in the White House, as being a very positive thing. There was a lot of talk about democratization of credit, which was touted as being a very positive thing. People who could never get credit before were getting credit because of risk-based pricing, and that was positive. And then you top it off by the fact that the data at the time showed that the loans were all performing. There was not a performance problem. People weren't defaulting on their mortgages. People were getting homes. People were, you know, happy, basically. Values were going up. There was a whole lot of positive energy going on around the housing market. And
my question was really more, yes,
part of the context.
I appreciate that. Is there something within the Federal Reserve in terms of the procedures it needs to go through? Or it's a hierarchical or a bureaucratic organization that prevents it from acting in a very fast, reactive mode?
I don't think it's within the Fed. I think the rule writing process in general, whether it's us or any other government agency, is by its nature, probably purposely so, is kind of cumbersome and clunky. And I think when I say purposely so, because it's supposed to be very thoughtful and deliberate. So as a result of that, you have to do a lot of data gathering first. You have to put out proposals for comments and leave them out for some length of time. Then you have to analyze all those comments, which I will tell you for our proposals have been considerable. And then you eventually churn it into a final rule. By nature, it is like next to impossible to come out with fast rules. which is one of the reasons why when we started seeing problems with some of these loans, we did guidance, because guidance can be done more quickly. And we knew it was not the final solution because we were working on rules at the same time, but we thought at least we could get some messages out there to the industry to let them know we were concerned about these things.
So now I want to talk a little bit about the Fed's policy of not examining non-bank subsidiaries
okay.
for consumer compliance. And I believe there was a policy adopted in 1998 that I should have brought the policy with me, so I apologize for paraphrasing it. But the 1998 policy said that it was formalizing a policy that had been Federal Reserve practice all along, which was not to evaluate non-bank subsidiaries of bank holding companies for violations of consumer compliance, consumer protection laws, and not to follow up on complaints about violations of those laws. Are you familiar with that 1998
policy? I've seen that document since then. I will tell you again, I was not division director back then, so I was not intimately involved in discussions around that. It's one of those things that being in the division, you kind of knew was going on, but it was not something that I was working on per se.
Okay, thanks. That may be your answer for this, but I'm going to ask anyway. Wait. Let me make sure this is the right. Yeah, this is right. This is FCIC 114823. And it's an email, and it attaches a memo, an August 31st, 2000 memo to Governor Gramlich from Dolores Smith and Glenn Loney. And I believe, did you say Dolores Smith was the division director
yes, she
at
was.
That time?
Yes, she was.
And Glenn Loney was
the deputy director.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And you can take a minute to look at the memo. It recommends, on the first page, the paragraph, "We recommend that as a first step, the system undertake a pilot program to carry out targeted inspections for predatory lending practices at a limited number of select non-bank subsidiaries." I'll give you a minute.
Okay. Yeah, I remember hearing about this.
Do you know what happened with this recommendation?
Well,
whether it was ever implemented?
It was not implemented.
Do you know why?
Well, my understanding is that there was a decision made at the board level not to implement it.
So your understanding is that this did make its way to the board?
Well, no, not formally, I should say. My understanding is that there were some, you know, offline conversations between Governor Gramlich and the chairman, and that as a result of those conversations, it was decided not to pursue this.
And what's the basis for your understanding?
Totally hearsay. I was not party to those conversations. Heard about them through Governor Gramlich.
So Governor Gramlich spoke to you about?
I was present in a room when he was informing group of staff that the chairman was not, he had spoken to the chairman and that he was not interested in going down this road.
Could you give us a little more of that conversation? Did Governor Gramlich tell you what he had presented to the
chairman?
No,
there was truly no detail that I remember. It was purely that, you know, he was just saying not to pursue, go down this road.
Did he say why?
I think there were a number of concerns. Again, this is totally, you know, just what I recall from the conversation. I think there were concerns about the resources that would be involved. I think there were also concerns about an unlevel playing field in the marketplace in the sense of non-bank subsidiaries. Their competition was independent companies, which we have absolutely no authority over at all, other than rulemaking, but not supervision authority, and that the idea was that if we started doing bank-like supervision in non-bank subsidiaries, they would be at a disadvantage to the independents, which basically had no on-site supervision.
Did Governor Gramlich express disappointment that this wasn't going to go forward?
I guess he wasn't like an emotional guy. So, I mean, he wasn't like, you know, I guess, you know, it's hard to answer that. You know, it was just, this is what it is. It was factual.
But did he support the proposal that the chairman decided was not a good idea, I guess is?
Well, he went to talk to him about it, so I assume he did.
Okay. Thank you. I think I have two more, but really only one. You know, I'm sure, the last one. This is FCIC 115090, and I believe you are actually copied on this. It's an email from Regina Watson to a whole host of what looked to be staff members and to Governor Gramlich, Mark Olson, and Lawrence Meyer. Were those the other two members of the Committee on Consumer and Community Affairs?
Yeah, I guess they were, yeah.
In January 2002.
Yeah. These guys change so often, it's hard to... I'm assuming they were, they were on the email.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it attaches a couple of memos. The first is a January 22nd, 2002 memo to the Consumer and Community Affairs Oversight Committee from Dolores Smith and Glenn Loney. The second is a January 16th memo from Glenn Loney to the Consumer and Community Affairs Committee. And the subject of this is supervision of bank holding companies for consumer compliance. And it references, let's see. I'll give you just a minute.
Okay.
So if you go to the first page of the January 22nd memo, I think if you flip back this way.
Oh.
The first paragraph talks about a survey that was conducted of the present involvement of the consumer affairs functions at the Reserve Banks in the oversight of holding companies. The survey was conducted as a follow-up to the decision made by the committee last year not to pursue establishing a formal policy of consumer compliance oversight of the holding companies. Are you familiar with the formal policy that was referenced here?
No.
Were you aware of a consideration about conducting compliance exams of bank holding companies for consumer protection?
Well, this would not have been actual exams. I think what this would have been, when we say consumer compliance oversight of bank holding companies, this means at the consolidated level. So we do a lot of things. You know, we have holding company responsibilities. And what we look for in the holding company is, do they have appropriate operations management systems in place to manage their subsidiaries, including the depositories and non-depositories. So it's a little bit different than an on-site transaction testing examination. So this was, I think, pertained, I don't know for sure, but I think this pertained more to how we were going to look for good consumer compliance by the holding company in terms of their systems.
If you go to, do you remember this? Do you know what
this?
No,
I don't. I mean, I'm looking at this. I must have seen it at the time, but frankly, I don't.
Do you know if it would have had anything to do with the policy about non-bank subsidiaries not being examined?
I don't know for sure. And so now I have to admit I'm a bit confused as to whether the conversation with Gramlich that I referenced before took place back in 98 or took place here. It may have been here. It may have been in 2002, the one, said the conversation I referenced previously.
Well, the memo I showed you previously was August 31st, 2000, that had to do with compliance inspections of non-bank subsidiaries.
So it was 2000, okay. I don't remember the exact date of when that conversation took place, so I'm not sure if it was after this or after that.
So this didn't really make an impression on you in 2002?
At the time, I was not involved in these matters.
Well, you were CC'd on this.
I know, but so were like 100 other people CC'd on this. We have a policy here for our oversight committee meetings that there is a distribution list that goes out to, there are a whole bunch of people from other divisions CC'd on these, and it's just the FYI.
Okay.
Purposes for what's going to be discussed at the meetings. I mean, it's, you know, some of the people CC'd on this are secretaries at the board. It's, you know, it's how we do distribution of Gov committee agendas and backup materials. And they go now, the ones that I do now, go out to, you know, 50 different people around the board. So it doesn't mean that they're familiar with the issues. It's just an FYI in case they want to come to the meeting.
Just to clarify, what kind of stuff would be looked at the holding company level regarding consumer complaints?
Well, at the time we were looking at things at the holding company level, you want to make sure that they have appropriate management audit systems in place to make sure that things are working in their in the subsidiaries, including the depositories. The holding company has some responsibility for corporate management. So you're looking at a very high level, 50,000-foot level, at compliance management to make sure that they've got something in place where they're taking some responsibility for what's happening in their subs.
So if you had done some sort of oversight of bank holding companies, would that have reached non-bank subsidiaries?
Well, there's two different pieces to this. So at one level, we could look, and I know we did for a number of years at that corporate level, to see what kind of systems have you put in place to make sure that what they're doing in this non-bank sub is okay. That's a different level that's actually going in on site to the sub itself and doing an examination, transaction testing, you know, doing a full-blown consumer compliance exam. One of the other things that I should have mentioned before in terms of reasons why we did not go into these and the decision was made not to was also because of Graham Leach Bliley. And Graham Leach Bliley had a provision in it that, you know, people refer to as Fed Light, that basically said for purposes of consumer compliance, we were supposed to defer to the primary functional regulators. And the primary functional regulators for the non-bank subs are not the Fed. It's the FTC and the states.
So I have a question about that, actually. If the Fed adopts a policy in 1998 and says we're formalizing a policy not to look at the non-bank subs for purposes of consumer protection, then in 1999, Graham Leach Bliley gets passed. Does that sort of negate the effect of the 1998 policy decision? Because the Fed wasn't looking at it anyway, and now it's not the Fed's job. It's the FTC's job.
Is that a legal question?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm asking for her understanding based on the practice of at the Fed. Ultimately, yes,
know.
It would be a legal question.
Yeah, I don't know how to answer that.
Well, it also comes up because it was, I think, in September 2009 that the board, after conducting a pilot program of reviewing non-bank subs, that it said, okay, actually now we are going to go in and look at non-bank subs and examine them for compliance on consumer protection. Now, does the Federal Reserve examine the non-bank subs now, or does the FTC examine them?
No, we do. The FTC doesn't examine anybody. They don't have the examination authority. They do have a whole other process over there. They don't do on-site exams. So the Federal Reserve is now taking responsibility, and we are in the process of instituting a program to do examinations in non-bank subs.
So if I'm trying to understand how Graham Leach Bliley fits in, I'm a little confused, because if Graham Leach Bliley did, in fact, change who was supposed to be looking out for the non-bank subs, then how is it that the Fed now goes in and conducts these?
Well, the Graham Leach Bliley provisions were looked at, but also I think there was a reexamination of our authority by the legal division, and you would have to ask them.
Okay,
so my understanding is that we also went back and looked at some specific consumer protection statutes. We are doing non-bank sub-exams for the statutes where we have specific enforcement authority that we can carry out in these subs. So it's not all of them. It's most of the big ones. But it's not all of them, and there was a determination made given the context of the time, the concerns about non-bank subs, the fact that nobody else was really looking at them, that we needed to, you know, I think be a little more aggressive in our authority and go in and look at them.
And the big ones are Fair Lending?
We're looking for Fair Lending, Truth in Lending, TILA. We can look at RESPA. We have a number of ones that we can,
the main ones. The notable exception is going to be CRA.
Well, they're not.
They have no
CRA obligations.
That's what I'm saying. That's the exception that you can't. They have no CRA exceptions.
They have no CRA obligations because they're not depositories. CRA is very explicit in the statute that it's only for FDIC-insured institutions.
What about HOPA? Would the exams now cover the recent HOPA rules?
Yeah, that's part of TILA. That's part
of truth and
lending.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Quick question. If you turn to page 5 of the second memo, it says the Reserve Bank's, this is, and again, we're going back to the world of 2002, and looking at what there were a few reserve banks that actually had been doing some consumer compliance reviews of bank holding companies. And this memo says the reserve banks as a whole presently do little by way of consumer compliance oversight of holding companies. Those few that do or have developed plans to do so have arrived at somewhat different approaches. Even some reserve banks that have given this matter a significant amount of thought have backed off from taking a strong stand in this regard because of budget concerns and because they are unsure of the board's preferences in this regard. Do you know what that would have been referring to, the board's preferences?
Well, there probably was some confusion out there because of the fact that we have this 1998 policy not to go into non-bank subs, and I'm not sure people understood, you know, if that also carried over into looking at holding companies.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming that's where the uncertainty came from.
Were you a part of any discussions from the 1998 policy to the September 2009 that
I was involved in all the discussions from 2004 on.
So were there discussions before the 2007 pilot program about whether the Fed should reverse this 1998 policy of not looking at non-bank subs?
Yes. I mean, that's why we undertook the pilot. We were talking about, given the circumstances of the markets at the time, the concerns we were seeing in the mortgage markets about mortgage products, especially coming out of non-bank subs, and also not just non-bank
subs. So when would that have happened?
But wait a minute. Also independent entities, which is why we did the pilot in conjunction with the FTC and the OTS, because we wanted to also have stronger looks, have them do stronger looks at the independents, which we have no authority for, we didn't go into. We were trying to do something so that they would all be looked at the same way at the same time, so we could try to get a handle around some of these practices that were going on.
So when did the discussions start that led to the pilot program?
Not long before the pilot. We did the pilot in 2007. I think we made a fairly quick decision. I think we started talking about it around, I'm trying to remember when we announced the pilot, when in 2007 that was. It was probably, we started talking about it several months before that. You know, I'm just guessing. I mean, I don't know exact dates on this stuff. You know, there was a lot going on right then, and this was one of many things that was going on in addition to, you know, writing HOPA rules and doing everything else. We were moving forward on a lot of tracks to try to get our arms around this issue. So this was one of many, but it didn't take that long for us to make the decision to move forward.
Were there any discussions? So let's go before. Let's put a line on whenever it was, 6 months or 8 months before the pilot program is announced. Going back in time, from the time you became director up until that point, had there been any other discussions about should we re-examine this 1998 policy of not examining non-bank subs for consumer compliance?
To the extent that you know.
I was going to say I do not remember specifically. There could have been.
The reason I asked going back to 2004 is because that's when you became director.
No, I understand that. I understand that. And so so another thing to put in context is that when I took over this division in 2004, there were a lot of issues here, and I was doing some major revamping of this division in a lot of respects in all parts of our work. So we had discussions, I had discussions with staff on a number of issues, pretty much every issue that was handled by this division, and was making a lot of changes, a lot of staffing changes, a lot of changes in our operations and procedures. So I am sure that in all that work, the issue of non-bank subs probably arose. I can't say that it didn't, but I don't recall specific conversation. It was in the context of major conversations going on about every aspect of the work of this division. So that, you know, probably did, but I don't remember specifics.
Thank you. Do you have more questions on non-bank subs?
Nothing.
Do you want to ask about fair lending?
Sure. You want me to? We've heard that early in the aughts, or let's say, to, you know, up until 2006, that one way to get at some of the predatory practices, potential predatory lending or unfair practices, may have been through fair lending exemptions. Since some of these were rumored to have targeted minority populations and potentially protected groups. Was that either official policy or sort of informally done by
examination
teams?
I don't remember that ever being stated as our official policy. I mean, certainly, I will tell you, ever since I've been in this division, we have always taken fair lending very seriously and done very robust examinations of institutions. I don't know that it was a specific way to get at predatory lending. I mean, it's certainly a piece of the problem, but we do fair lending for other matters, too, and we've always done a very rigorous program. We have very sophisticated analytical tools that we use in that examination process. We look at these complaints very seriously, and when we find that there is reason to believe that there's a pattern of practice, we always refer to justice.
But there's no, do you get the sense that examination teams would have used this sort of informally to go after parts of the subprime market, particular subprime behavior?
No, I think, I mean, we've got fair lending exams that go on in all parts of the institution. We've had a number of referrals we've made on auto lending, for instance, that have nothing to do with the housing market. We've made a number of referrals on that, where people have been charged different prices, we feel, based on race and even other things like marital status. And so, we look at fair lending across the board, not just in housing, but in, you know, all aspects of lending that the bank does.
How significant does a fair lending violation have to be to reach the threshold where you would send it to the DOJ? Would there ever be a step down where you'd work with the institution to fix the problem before you send it over? Or,
well, we're somewhat constrained by the statute, and I don't think that's a bad thing, in that if we identify that there's truly a reason to believe that there was discrimination there, we have no choice but to refer it. There are things that institutions do to fix the problem. We don't let them go on. So we certainly talk to the institution about fixing the problem, but just because they fix the problem doesn't mean that there wasn't discrimination. And we have, in many cases, referred institutions who are sitting there saying, but I fixed it, and that doesn't matter if it took place, we still make the referral. And it's also not a matter of intent either, because that's the other thing that happens sometimes. You know, there's different kinds of discrimination, and some of it is quite blatant and easy to nail, and others of it is, it may be a disparate impact kind of situation where they have a policy and they just didn't realize that it was, and they're like, but we didn't intend to discredit. That doesn't matter either. If there is a disparate impact that arises, whether they intended it or not, it still gets referred to justice.
Do you know if there's any follow-up to, I think we've seen the documents on the countrywide referral to the DOJ today, because it was about the same time that countrywide left the Fed supervision and went to the OTS, surprisingly.
Yeah, you can draw your own conclusions from that. I don't know that they have finished with that yet. I don't know. I haven't heard anything.
Did they tell
recently.
You?
Sometimes they have discussions with Carol Evans, who is our head of our fair lending unit here. I think she sometimes talks to Justice, and a lot of times they don't tell her anything, I think, until they're getting ready to have a settlement or put out some kind of order, they'll give her a heads up that we came to agreement or, you know, this is coming forward. But I really don't know as to whether there's been, I haven't heard anything. That's like seems a long time ago now because we've had a lot of other cases after that. So I don't know where they are. And it takes them a while to churn through stuff. You know, we refer, which is one of the other frustrations sometimes, is we'll send stuff to justice. It could be a couple years before the matter gets settled.
I'm good.
Are you done on fair lending?
Yep.
So I'd like to move to the Community Reinvestment Act.
Okay.
And this is my last document for you. It's not bait stamped because it's public. This is your testimony in May of 2007. And on page 3,
yes,
the last paragraph that carries over with one word to page 4, says that since 1998, there have been more than 13,500 applications for the formation, acquisition, or merger of bank holding companies or state member banks reviewed by the Federal Reserve. It says... No, I've lost it. Oh, here it is. Over this time, 25 of these applications have been denied, with 8 of those failing to obtain board approval involving unsatisfactory consumer protection and community needs issues.
Okay, so...
Do you know what the 8 ones were?
Oh, I offhand know, but we could get you that information. I mean, they would be in the records.
If we could get that, a list of that,
okay,
that would be really helpful.
Yeah, well, Dave, can you make a note of that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we can pull that. That's not difficult. Those are public records.
Okay. Okay. That would be helpful. One of the questions that we'd like to sort of toss up here is, how does the Federal Reserve think about commitments to do things in the community in the future when it examines these applications?
So, for example, there's different kinds of commitments.
Okay.
There are commitments that are made between the institution and community organizations, and those are considered private commitments. We do not get involved with those. Those are aside from what we're looking at in the record. But then there are commitments that they sometimes make to us to fix programs or to do things. When they make commitments to us, we monitor them.
Would it ever be the case, has it ever been the case, that a firm came in with an unsatisfactory or in some way deficient Community Reinvestment Act status grade and was able to still go through with an application because of a commitment it made to you, to the Fed?
I can't sit here and say out of 25,000 or 13,000 cases that... Absolutely not, but most likely I would say no. There's a couple things, because you only read the first couple lines of that paragraph. It also goes on to say that the banks who have bad records generally don't put forward an application. They are deterred before they get to that point, and I know that that happens, where an institution will come in and say that they want to file some kind of merger, acquisition, or expansion application, and we have said to them, don't do it because of your record. You need to fix your record and come back later. So you left that part out, and that we do not have counts on, but we have those conversations with institutions. Institutions are sent away, told to go away and come back later after they fix things. And so,
Fixing things include a commitment to a community organization?
We generally don't. The private commitments, banks can make those. What we consider fixing things is that our examiners take a look at their record and feel that they have a good record of meeting the community needs. So it's assessment we make, not the community group telling us, well, you know, this bank has pledged $100 billion to loans in our community and we're happy now. That's not what we consider fixing it.
So let's say that a bank lets you know that it's wanting to put in an application, mm-hmm, and the Fed tells it, looking bad here, you need to fix this before you actually come to us with this, mm-hmm, application. the bank goes out and it pledges to spend $1 million on various loans and the commitment.
That's not commitment.
Okay, so my question is, half of those loans get made before it comes back to you. They actually commit that they actually make $500,000 worth of loans in the community before they come back to you. Do the $500,000 count?
It's not that specific because we're also looking at what kind of systems have they put in place that we feel that the changes they've made to their program are going to be sustainable and long-lasting, and that they have a process in place to assess those community needs, to meet those community needs, that they are meeting those community needs, and it looks like something that's institutionalized within the organization. They have the proper controls on it. It's not just the number of the amount of loans they've made. It's also looking at how the CRA process has been mainstreamed into the institution and is controlled appropriately so that we feel comfortable that they actually have beefed up their compliance, that they're paying attention, that they're going to do what they need to do going forward, that it's not going to, we approve the application and then everything stops. We have to feel comfortable that they've got the right people in the right places. So it's more than, it's not just a matter of how many counting loans. It's much more than that as part of the CRA exam.
Was there ever a point when the board did give more credit for third-party commitments than it does now?
Not that I know of it since 87, and that's something I have, you know, I've taught CRA. That was something I was hired for. I came out of the community side. I was always told that the board's policy the board's policy from day one was that private commitments are private commitments. Now, obviously, you could say in a kind of third-party way, if they made this commitment with an organization and they actually were following through with it, I mean, that's going to reflect on their record. So that's something we're looking at, but we're not monitoring to see they promised greenlining $2 million in this neighborhood. Did they make that $2 million at Greenline? They promised greenlining. We're not following up on that commitment. We're looking at their record, and a part of that record is that they made some loans off of this private agreement they had. We look at it in the context of their entire record.
As someone who is relatively new to all of this, why do banks make CRA commitments with private third parties or with community groups
I think they feel political pressure often to do that. There's a PR component to it. There's a big PR. There used to be, you know, I don't know that we see as many of those now as we used to see in the old days. I think that's kind of waned. In the old days, it was like who could throw up the biggest telephone number. And it was a big PR component of mergers and acquisitions is, you know, there was almost like this bidding war going on with some of the large institutions, it seemed to us, where who could pledge the most to the communities. But that was something that they chose to do. We never pressured them to do that. That was something they did for their own internal reasons.
To the other issue that's come up in our research and investigation is the CRA is very specific about the lending test and being within assessment areas.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the CRA commitment dollars, for example, seem to include dollars outside of those assessment areas and the like. And the Q&A, as I understand it, is specific to you are judged first in your assessment area and then possibly outside that. Are we understanding
right.
that correctly?
That is correct. They're
is there
first
any credit given an official CRA exam to dollars outside of
the assessment absolutely. Area? Oh, absolutely. They have to be taking care of their assessment area. If we feel that they're doing a good job in their assessment area and then they do some other things that have more national, you know, impact, they get recognition for that. Absolutely, all the time. You know, there's a lot of, like, partnerships that they may participate in that are more national in scope and that have a big impact on regional areas or national areas, they definitely get commitment. They definitely get recognition for that. But the concern is the primary responsibility. They can't do those things and do nothing at home, basically. Okay, they have to be taking care of home, and then if they do these other things, that's kind of gravy. to, you
are
know.
Are those usually going to be under the investment tests and the service
some
tests?
Some of them
or
would
are
be.
They going to also be under the lending test, in particular single-family mortgage? Does that ever seem to be enough part of them?
It could. I guess it could. Yeah, it could be in any of the three tests.
And is it your sense that the banks, let's say, is sort of this political pressure or this weird game theoretic, they got into this weird arms race of commitments, that they ever felt the pressure to go beyond, to make unsafe or unsound loans?
That I do not think. If you're getting at whether or not CRA helped cause the subprime mess, I absolutely, definitively say that it did not. And I have said that publicly, and you probably know. I have said that in Congress when I have testified quite definitively. I still believe that. I keep saying it. I have said it not just in this country. I've said it when I've been overseas speaking in January to French bankers who asked me that question. I think the data, and I am sure you've gotten a copy of Glenn Cantor's study on this, I think the data shows quite definitively that CRA-covered institutions did more responsible lending. That is a big part of CRA that people forget oftentimes, is that it's right in the statute that they are to do safe and sound lending. And I think CRA-covered institutions did responsible lending. Most of the irresponsible lending was done by institutions that were not covered by CRA. So, and I will state that from now until you will never get me to change my mind on that. It was in no way responsible for this crisis.
To be thorough, we had to ask.
No, that's fine that you asked.
I think that I'm done with my questions. So it's been really helpful. We appreciate your taking the time. We hope that the rest of your anniversary can be spent in a more fun manner.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
End tape.